Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, are you with me yet?
I just tuned in just now.
Well, that was perfect timing, Red.
Yeah.
I hope your afternoon's been going well.
Well, I don't know if it went well, but it was sure busy.
I'm sure. It's been a busy couple of days, especially in the news with all of the craziness of forged birth certificates and everything else that's going on. Edgar Steele's trial has started, and they picked their jury up there. And where is that trial taking place, Red?
Boise, Idaho.
Well, I'm not sure exactly when Carl will be calling in here. I'm sure he'll be on shortly. I know he was coming from another meeting, so he's supposed to call in as soon as he's available, and we'll just hang in there until he shows up, and we've got plenty to talk about. Red, do you feel like openings with a prayer tonight?
I can. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the day which You have given to us, and we just thank You because You have been so good to us. You have blessed us in so many ways. And we need to count our blessings because You have just done so much. We thank You for this opportunity to speak out for that which is right and identify that which is wrong. And we need Your guidance. We need Your wisdom. We need to be able to ask Your help in deciding between good and evil. We thank Thee because You have given this ability, this blog radio, to where we can contact and deal with people all over the world, basically. And we thank You for that. And we just pray now that You would help us to speak only truth. Truth is a scarce commodity, it seems, today. And we need to have a record of standing for truth so that when we stand before You as our judge, You would be our judge. We want it on our records that we stood for truth. We thank You now, and we'll ask all of this in Thy precious name. Amen.
Hallelujah. Well, Red, I'm gonna post some websites in our chat room about the Edgar Steele trial, and if you wouldn't mind, I know that you got some information regarding some of the actions that the judge has taken to try to prevent expert witness testimony, that sort of thing. If you could just give us a little description of what you know about that, I think that would be helpful.
Well, the FBI, most of what they have as far as evidence is supposedly phone calls, which they recorded, and they say in these phone calls that Edgar was plotting or planning on murdering his wife and his mother-in-law. And they had a witness. He had been a handyman around, and Edgar had had used him to do some things. We have to remember that it wasn't too many months ago that Edgar had a very serious heart problem, and we just about lost him. And so he was using this handyman to do some work around there. And, of course, Edgar says that the handyman stole a bunch of his wealth. He had some silver stashed, and the guy found out where it was at or something. And anyway, he's supposed to have swiped it. And so anyway, he is the government's basically the sole witness that they have, I believe.
Let me contribute just a little bit before you talk about what the judge has done. This handyman turned out to be an FBI informant. And Edgar had him do some construction work at Edgar's home. And, in fact, he built a secret room, either in an office garage or on the house, where he could put, you know, valuables. Like, he had a lot of silver. He had like $40,000 or $50,000 worth of silver that he wanted to store in there. And this handyman had been around and working with some of the various liberty groups that Edgar had been associated with for a couple of years. And of course, they didn't know that he was an FBI informant. But it also turned out that this guy had debts of like over between $600,000 and $700,000. And after he did the construction work for Edgar, after the room was finished and Edgar had put some of his silver in this room, this man came and stole that silver out of that storage room. And then to cover up his plot, he placed these bombs underneath Edgar and his wife's car. And, of course, the bombs were not properly set, and, in fact, they did not go off. And when one of the cars was taken to a mechanic shop, they discovered this bomb and then checked the other car and found it as well. And then this man came forward with his accusations to the FBI, which he was an informant for, and he accused Edgar of hiring him to kill his wife and mother-in-law, and said that he deliberately didn't make them good bombs, and that's why they didn't go off, because he didn't want, you know, he was just setting Edgar up, is basically what he claimed. And then, of course, you can take it from there.
Yeah, well, I hadn't intended to go that deep into it. I'm glad you did, because it's part of the story, of course, that needs to be told. What I was trying to bring out was that a week ago today, they had a hearing. Now, the trial was supposed to start on the 26th. That's this last Tuesday. But they had this pretrial in federal court there in Boise. Justice Department, they went in and had a motion, or a motion in limine, which is a motion for the judge to consider withholding certain information, certain evidence. And the defense, Edgar's defense, had done is brought in a couple of experts on tapes, the authenticity and such of these audio tapes, and both of them came to the conclusion very quickly that the tapes were phony, that the FBI had fabricated these tapes that were going to be used as evidence. And, of course, their idea was that if they could disqualify and make the tapes so that they had no effect, whatever, because the jury would figure that out, that it was government mischief. And so, sure enough, the judge went and granted the motion in limine. And so the defense on Edgar's trial on the weekend, they were really working hard to try to figure out how they were going to defend this case, because basically the judge stole refused to let them bring that evidence in about the fact that these tapes are fraud. They're perpetrated by the FBI. And so here you see is one of the situations that I keep talking about. The judge is a government agent, just as the FBI agents that are going to be on the case and the U.S. attorney there. That judge, I think it's a female if I remember right, that judge has a conflict of interest because that judge is on the government payroll. And this is an action, the United States of America against Edgar Steele. And so I talked to Pat Shannon this afternoon, and he said he's been there since Tuesday, the start of the trial. And he said it's going a lot better than what he estimated or, you know, guessed, because everybody was worried about the fact that they couldn't question those FBI tapes. He said that this handyman informant, that he's a real dud, and the defense attorneys, when it came time for them to cross-examine him, they just chewed him up and spit him out. I guess they had him on the witness stand, I think Pat said, a day and a half. And they just tore his testimony apart a piece at a time. And he looked pretty bad by the time they got done with him. Pat says it looks much better. When he called me this afternoon, he said that Cindy, Edgar's wife, was on the witness stand, and she was doing an excellent job. And I guess she projected to everybody in the courtroom how this was such a disgusting thing. It was just such a charade that the government was putting on. And so she was on the witness stand. I think she's going to be back again tomorrow. But he said her testimony was very good. I'm kind of wondering if the trial will last 2 weeks as they thought it would. Pat is going to fly back home on Tuesday. He's only going to be there a week. But, of course, he's coming over here on Saturday. He'll be here Saturday to interview me for some more of those DVDs that we're trying to do. So I got that much from a live witness at the, in the courtroom. And Pat, of course, knows his way around the courtroom very well. He's done a lot of this kind of thing. And when he says that the lawyers, the defense lawyers, really tore that government informant, that handyman, they just tore him apart. He they beat him up with their questioning, apparently. So that will have quite an effect, I'm sure.
Well, you would expect Steele to know, who to hire to defend him, because he's a lawyer himself and has, of course, was a defense attorney. And I guess we probably ought to give a little bit of history. There may be some folks listening that don't know who Edgar Steele is. And Steele had represented some white supremacist groups, Aryan Nation groups up there. He had been their lawyer on some cases and had had some success. And, of course, the ADL didn't like that at all. And Steele also has written some books, which I'll let you talk about here in a second. But he's been a radio personality, and he has attacked particularly the Khazarians, the Ashkenazi. And he had really been vocal in his radio shows about that. And he would have people call in and name one of them and specify, you know, some of the crimes that they had basically done against our country. And the ADL really had him as a poster child. I mean, they wanted him nailed. And so they, you know, they're the ones that have been really, I think, driving a lot of this with the FBI, et cetera, to trump up these charges on him. So they wanted him. I mean, he's much like our friend Schaefer Cox up in Alaska. He was just too vocal and was having too much of an impact. I mean, at one point, Edgar Steele was going to try to run for governor of Idaho. So that give you a little perspective of how well respected he was in that area, and he actually had, you know, a bit of support. I think he was anyway. That's as far as I need to go with that. But you want to mention his book that he wrote?
Yes, he. I never did meet him. He wrote a book, Defensive Racism, and. In that book, he explains very carefully and thoroughly how that the races, you see, they're trying to, inject this idea of interracial marriage and such in this country. And he's a very good writer. And he was writing about what these scoundrels, these international banker types and such, that they are trying to, pollute the bloodline of the white American. And there's been a certain amount of all people saying the enemy. Let me say the Ashkenazi. That is a person that claims to be a Jew, a race. Not a, they would like to have themselves called a race, but they're not. They're members of the religion we know of as Judaism. And
but they're proselytes. They're Germanic.
Yeah, they have absolutely. Yeah, they have absolutely no trace of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob's blood in their line, in their family tree. It isn't there, and that's why they're called Ashkenazis. They were proselyted to become part of the Judaism religion. And so there's some reports now that say that 90% of the known Jews in the world today are Ashkenazis. In other words, they are the proselytes. And, of course, if anybody wants to take their Bible and look something up, they need to look at Matthew 23:15. I hope somebody will put their finger on that and perhaps call it in. And I pretty well remember, or I memorized the verse. Christ is pretty well scolding the scribes and the Pharisees in that chapter. And in that verse, the 15th verse, he says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte. And when you have made him, he becomes the twofold son of hell, even worse than yourselves." Now, the scribes and the Pharisees are the hierarchy of Judaism. They're the top echelon of people in the religion of Judaism, and Christ Himself, He says, you're going out and you're proselyting, which means that Christ knew that they were not a race of people, that Judaism is a religion, and so because races do not proselyte, it's only religions that proselyte. And he's telling me, you go out and you proselyte and you get somebody to become a part of your Judaism thing, and they are twice as dangerous. He says that you become, they become the twofold sons of hell. And so even worse than yourselves, he says. So what he's saying is that the scribes and the Pharisees, of course, he'd already called them hypocrites, but he says that they are not good people. They're bad people. And these proselytes are twice as bad. And so that's what we've got so much of in our world today, and that's the problem with the ADL. They don't like Edgar Steele because he has defined this and researched it and defined this problem very well. And so the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, they really have gone out of their way to work with the FBI and such to try to lock Edgar Steele up and get him out of their hair, you know. And so it's not a pretty picture. The ADL is, for the most part, I don't think there's a one in the active ADL that is other than an Ashkenazi Jew.
And let's be clear about this. We understand who the remnant is and who the Hebrews were and who the people of Israel were. And specifically what we're saying here is that we're not talking about something that's anti-Semite. We're talking about these people who were Germanic people who really now control our banks and our media and our entertainment system. These are not the chosen people of God, of Israel. These are really, if anything, chosen people of Satan, correct?
Yes, and, this is what's unique about Edgar Steele, and I know of a number of these kind of people out there that Edgar himself is not a professing Christian. He'll probably be a professing Christian when he gets through this ordeal, but when he wrote the book Defense of Racism, he isn't injecting the religious into it at all, or the Bible for that matter. He just looks at the facts. He looks at the activities of these people and their efforts to bring about this new world order, because in Judaism, their God has promised them that they will at some point rule the world. And that is their goal, is to eventually rule the world. And they'll use whatever lies and misinformation and all that kind of thing. They'll use whatever it takes to try to reach that point.
Now, some of our listeners are not familiar with the ADL, and our good buddy out in California has put in that it's the Anti-Defamation League. But to try to give some perspective on this, these are people who are very much associated with the Southern Poverty Law Center, correct?
The ADL work right with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
That'll give our listeners, I think more people are probably familiar with that today, even though some years ago they might have been familiar with the ADL. They're certainly familiar with the SPLC. And so I hope that helps you, Nancy. Nancy, one of our regulars, was asking that question. I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah. The ADL, you see, where the problem is, we've got all these evangelical religions out here that teach that a Jew is God's chosen, and they don't differentiate between a proselyte and an Israelite. The Israelites, they don't go out and proselyte. they don't, you know, racists just don't proselyte because you don't change your bloodline. The only people that do proselyting is religious organizations. You know, I say, well, the Catholics are always trying to proselyte the Baptists, and the Baptists are trying to proselyte the Catholics, and they try to get people to buy into their belief system and become Baptists or Methodists or whatever, you see. This is a failure on the part, it's a theological error that has been perpetrated to such an extent that I've just made a wild guess, of course, that there's 50 to 60 million evangelical Christians in this country who have been misled and mistaught about the, you know, who is God's chosen. The children of Israel are God's chosen, not the adherents of Judaism, the religion of Judaism. And, of course, you see, it's really, really difficult for people to explain all this. They believe what they were taught from their pulpits, and they didn't look into it on their own to check it out.
Let's come back to the point that we're trying to make, because I think this is important that we focus on the fact that Edgar Steele is another example of a political prisoner.
Yes.
It really shows who is really behind and controlling this government, our media, our schools. It really points to all of that. And Edgar's not alone. You know, you can look at you know, through the years, and we could point out a whole slew of people who have been political prisoners. And this Obama administration is, you know, has really stepped things up. You know, it's been going on for a long time. It's not new in the Obama administration. As a matter of fact, I would even suggest that some of the past administrations over the last 40 or 50 years are still in control of things and have been doing this political prisoner process of making good people out to be bad people and trumping things up on them. And if they start to be effective, they want to try to take them down, just like they did to Schaefer Cox up in Alaska. But he's not alone. Red, I'm sure you can give us some people like Ezra Pound. Was that one guy's name that was certainly a political prisoner?
Yeah, after World War II. He was a poet, wasn't it?
Yes.
And such, and a very learned individual. And Eustace Mullins worked with Ezra Pound, and that's how Eustace Mullins had the background that he did to write the books that he did about the Federal Reserve Bank and all of that. And, of course, I knew Eustace Mullins quite well. And on the speaking tours, I crossed trails with him many a time. And he was not one bit timid about, going after these proselytes to Judaism. He called them what they are and what they are doing. And, of course, I was mentioning, I figure, 40 to 50 million that are mistaught. They're taught theological error. And, see, that is the power behind the ADL. Jewish, what's the acronym there for AIPAC? AIPAC is the organization that has more control of the U.S. Congress than any other organization. And they get so much of their power from these people who have been taught all their lives that the Jew is God's chosen. And so this is the kind of thing that Edgar Steele was never bashful about going after. He would defend unpopular things, people that had been targeted by the ADL and such. He would go and defend these people, and many of them had no assets. They had no way of paying him, and he would go and defend them pro bono. And that means he didn't charge these people to defend them. And he was just a fellow that had figured out how that our government had become a criminal government. He had figured that out, and he dedicated his life to try to do what he can to correct it.
Well, I think we probably covered that about as well as we can cover it tonight, and we'll give a report next week on how the trial went, and hopefully there will be some good result from that. And the interesting thing that I will add is that the prosecution elected to get rid of quite a few men from the jury pool. And they ended up with, of the 12 jury members and two substitutes or alternates, they ended up with 13 women and one man. And the thinking there is that the prosecution really messed up, because here you're dealing with a guy who's accused of trying to kill his wife, and his wife is probably his number one witness in his defense.
Yeah.
And that could turn out to haunt them by having, I'm not sure where the man is, whether he's in the jury or in the alternates, but we know that there's at least 11 ladies on that jury, and they may very well sympathize with Edgar Steele's wife, and that could blow up in the prosecution's face.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't heard that about the numbers, that it was women like that. I hadn't heard that part of it. Pat didn't tell me that. I'll get more lowdown on it on Saturday when he's here.
Well, I look forward to that, and I'm hoping we can get Pat to come back on the show here sometime in the next couple of weeks and talk to us about that and other things. He's got a lot to talk about. So.
Yeah, well, Pat is a good, he's a good guest, and he won't hesitate to come on and explain what he saw and what he heard there. The whole thing smells so bad that I can't imagine those 13 women and or 12 women and two alternates, how they could, sit through this thing and not see, the mischief that is being perpetrated by our U.S. Justice Department. You remember that case here just a couple or 3 months ago about the jury in Missoula, Montana? And it was in state court, and it was they were prosecuting a fellow for having 1/16 of an ounce of marijuana in his house. They raided him, and all they could find was 1/16 of an ounce, and they were prosecuting, and they were trying to pick a jury in the criminal case to try this case. And one of the women on the jury panel, and I think there is about 40 on that panel, she just spoke up. She said, "I don't care if I'm called for jury. If I'm picked for the jury, I'm going to vote not guilty. I don't care what the evidence says." She said, "I'm sick and tired of these kind of things where You people in the courts and the politics, you're always wanting more money and more money and more money. And here you are prosecuting this silly case, and this was during the jury selection. Excuse me. And it just blew the case right out the window because there was 22 other people on the jury that agree on the jury panel that agreed with her. Now, this is something we need to see a lot of in this country, where people are sitting on a jury panel in the jury selection, and they need to speak up and challenge the prosecution and challenge the court on how they have performed. It needs to be done.
Well, Red, I'm thinking I probably ought to call Carl and make sure he's got the right number with him to call in, because I know he
mm-hmm.
was coming out of a meeting and he was at first wanting me to call him to right at 7, and I'm just suspecting I need to give him a quick call.
Yeah.
So if you got something you want to talk about for just a minute, it'll only take me a second.
I'll try to fill in the hole. We don't want any dead air. I'm working very hard at the present time to put things together. When Pat Shannon is here on Saturday, we're going to produce a couple more DVDs. The last two we did were most everybody that has seen them, that have looked at them, think they're great, but I think I can do a better job if I've got Pat Shannon interviewing me, and we've had more time to think about it. And I, when we start out, I'm going to say that the federal government is self-destructing, and that this is not something that should be a surprise, because governments, they always seem to, if they get too much power, why, they always self-destruct. This is what's happened, of course, in Tunisia and Egypt. It's handling, it's happening in Libya and Syria, all these different places, and the government gets too much power. When they can send troops into the streets to shoot people in cold blood, you know that that government has too much power. And they, that power is being mishandled and misused. And so those governments go down. In my lifetime, there has been so many governments that have I have a favorite line. I say they have been thrown on the junk heaps of history. And so when we do this DVD, I'm going to bring out how that the federal government seems to be in a self-destructing mode. And so I'm going to ask the question, where did the federal government in this country, where did they get this amount of power, this tremendous amount of power that they have? Because they have enough, they have enough power to destroy themselves. And this has happened many, many, many times in history. Governments have self-destructed when they have too much power. And so where did the federal government that we have today, where did they get this power to plunder the American people of their wealth and their futures and everything? And where did they get it? Well, the only source of power for a government is we the people. And so we have to make just a simple deduction. If our government has too much power, it's very simple. We the people have been giving them too much of our power. When we give too much of our power to government, then we end up powerless. We don't have enough power to do anything, to accomplish anything in life or anything else. We're in trouble. And so this is going to be the starting point for these DVDs. And, of course, we're going to be trying our best to focus on the angry American, and we'll use the Tea Party people to demonstrate what angry Americans, how many there are, and how they're determined they're going to make some change. And so we've got to get across to the American people somehow that the Constitution for the United States of America was a law which we the people wrote. We wanted to have a government of law, not men. And we have ended up with a government of men, not law. The case of Edgar Steele, where the judge ruled that they cannot use the testimony of experts that have more or less identified these audio tapes that the FBI supposedly got by, tapping into the telephone lines. And so the judge made a ruling that the defense can't use those. And the experts that have examined them, two of them, they have the experience. So the one of them is a PhD, and he had identified something, if I remember right, over 300 different mistakes on those tapes that the government had been patching these tapes, putting in voices and things that, Edgar says that he did not say these things. That was not his conversation. It was not his voice. And, of course, a lot of people that knew Edgar have had a chance to listen to him, and they all say the same thing, that it's obvious that these are a malfunction, a part of it's something that the FBI is doing that should send somebody to jail for this kind of mischief, where they're picking on a guy with manufactured evidence. And it just it makes us ill to our stomach when we think about how they will stoop so low in the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department to try to fabricate telephone calls that they say they intercepted, and you know, use those phony telephone recordings to destroy somebody.
By the way,
you're back. Okay.
Oh yeah, I've been here for a while. You were just on a roll. I didn't want to interrupt you. Some people have asked what your DVDs are about, and I've entered into the chat there a little bit about the pecking order, the fact that God is the number one sovereign, that we the people are under God, that under the people is the Constitution, and under the Constitution is the government, and then other service institutions that are there to really serve the people and the good of the people and the common good. But the point is that, and let's see, I'm getting a message here from Carl is live. Carl Swenson.
Hello. Is this live?
This is Terry, and you're on with
Terry,
Red Beckman as well.
Red, how are you doing, sir?
Good to hear. I'm getting by.
Well, you keep doing what you're doing, sir. You're doing God's work, and you're an inspiration to a lot of people out there, me included.
Well, Carl, let me let everybody know that the first time I ever spoke to you, and I don't even remember how long ago it was now, it was when you guys put that first grand jury, citizens grand jury together down in Georgia, and you were on somebody's show, and I was at that time, I think I was still over at Patriot's Heart Network, and you were doing a lot over there as well, and we got to talking, and you know, we've it's kind of been a ongoing touch and go from here, and we've stayed in touch with each other on and off, and really appreciated the work that you've done with the Citizens Grand Jury, and now you're working with Commander Fitzpatrick very closely, and
yep.
We really appreciate we appreciate you rushing away from your other meeting that you were directing down there, and spending time with us to give us some insight as to where this thing has gone. We know a lot of our listeners are probably aware of what Commander Fitzpatrick has gone through. We've had him on the show, so some of these listeners have actually heard Walt himself, but we're kind of wanting an update to know what this move is to talk about foreign people being in these positions and the treason charges and how this is a new thing, really, to take these charges and to submit them directly to a federal grand jury. Can you give us a little background on where you are with that and what Walt is trying to accomplish now?
Well, Walt, as you know, was arrested, incarcerated. He's charges were fabricated and brought against him, just as they were fabricated and brought against me. I'm still dealing with that, and really, I can't wait to have my day in court as soon as I can find a judge that hasn't illegally appointed a grand jury foreman in his particular district. I just recused the last judge because of it, and the next one coming up will be the next one on my list because I know that he's also done that in his district. So that's where we're going, and Walt is, gratefully, he's I'm following his path, actually, not the other way around. He's done so much work to uncover who these people are and what their role is. These judges are jury tampering, for lack of a better term, and getting away with it. The lawyers in the state, and we're talking about the state of Tennessee and the county of Monroe County, the 10th Judicial District, these people have been, for over 20 years, completely bastardizing the jury system. They use their grand jury foreman as employees, literally as employees. These people are so arrogant that the grand jury foreman drive around with emblems for the county on their cars. I mean, it's brazen, absolute brazen. So it is incumbent upon us to not just call this out, but to fight this, because our last refuge, our last, very last hope in this country is to retake our grand juries. Now, I want to slightly correct you. You used the term citizens grand jury. When I first did a grand jury, I did so as a common law grand jury because I know that the I know that the citizens grand jury has other connotations that make me less than sovereign. But a common law grand jury puts me in a completely different realm and empowers me to do exactly what it was that we did, and that was to come up with a presentment for the existing power structure to act upon. The fact that they did not only shows their complete disdain for the Constitution. Chief Justice Royce Lamberth up in the DDD District Court said it very eloquently when he refused to take our presentment. He said, although I find this grand jury to be constitutional, I can find no statutes that allow me to proceed. Those words, when I read them, they caused something to go off inside of me. Yes, part of it was anger, but the other part was a burning desire to find out what the hell he was talking about. Because I know that it is incumbent upon them to act upon the presentments of a grand jury. And Red, am I wrong in that?
Well, no, I'll let Red answer, but the point is that the judiciary and the bar have deliberately written common law, especially common law grand juries, out of the rules of civil and criminal procedure.
Well,
and that's
sir,
not an
well,
accident.
Curiously, they didn't write it out. They didn't.
They
said it was antiquated. That's it.
Well,
they just said it was antiquated.
It's no longer contained in the rules of civil procedure or criminal procedure.
Ah, dig. It is there. It is there.
Well,
all
where
they
is
did.
It? Because I thought Lambert particularly said that he couldn't find it.
Well, what he was saying is that he can find no precedent, no case law that allows him to proceed. And that, my friend, is what the 1946 rules of criminal procedure were all about. They were about instilling case law and precedent as a means to trump the Constitution. But again, when they did that, and I don't have it in front of me, I'm just driving back from my meeting, but I'll be more than happy to give it to you at a later date. That particular codification of the rules of criminal procedure specifically said that they were antiquated, not that they were disallowed, not that they were removed, just that they were antiquated. So that's what has been
let me inject something here.
Sure.
You see, the reason they're antiquated, and they're absolutely true, I mean, that's what's happened. The people sitting on the jury, grand juries now, have no power because they've given too much of their power to government. And so you need people on the grand jury that recognize their sovereignty and that they are above government, they are above the Constitution, and you see, they don't have that background. They don't understand that. And so they're just stumbling around in the dark, and so that's why they call them antiquated.
That is absolutely correct. And further, we have a bit of a problem, and that problem is that the education of America right now is such that they don't know what their rights are. They just don't know. And they're not going to be explained those rights in an adequate fashion by the DAs and prosecutors who put information before them. So as long as that's the case, then the judicial controls the grand jury and in turn controls us.
And the grand jury should be in control of the judge.
You know, Red, we know how this is supposed to work. Now, how do we get it back there? I'm of the impression that we can only do so by using shock treatment. That is what Walt has been doing. And that is what I will carry the banner, and I will do. If we can hold them accountable in one area, in this country, one place, because all it takes is one of the dominoes to fall, and the rest may very well fall with them. Or they may circle the wagons. I don't know. But to have the opportunity to have this fight is a glorious thing for me. I will risk jail. I will risk anything because I'm fighting for us. And that's the only way I can look at this. Now tonight I had a meeting with I'm the new chairman for my Republican Party in my county. Because I've been working this angle now for the past year and a half, knowing that I'm not having a whole bunch of luck working from the outside. Hey, let me start working from the inside, and it's reaping rewards and benefits that I hadn't realized before. Sunday night, I'll have a meeting with the governor. And I get to express a few things to him. But tonight's meeting, I had people that are seeking a chair position for the state Republican Party. Now, everybody in my membership, and they're about 50 strong now and growing, everybody there knows where I come from with the Constitution. I start every meeting now with reading at least 5 minutes of the Constitution. I've got a kid from Clayton State College down here that has joined us. He was a former libertarian. Now he's a Republican and wants to get involved. And we showed them tonight exactly how the people can start to take this back. And you take it back first at the precinct level and at the county level. In my wildest dreams, I would not have imagined that my talking at the various county groups around this area would have resulted in us actually taking it over in an entire congressional district, which is what we've done. So things are moving faster than I could ever have imagined. But these candidates were up before us tonight. And we were grilling them with questions of the Constitution. We were grilling them on how they are going to uphold or hold the elected representatives' feet to the fire. They understand that there's only two ways to do it. One is at the ballot box, and the other is with bullets. That is the bottom line. Now, we may be too late at the ballot box, but I will continue to fight thinking that I have time. I will continue to fight because I think we have time. But we grilled them on this. And they were pretty much, they didn't understand the complexities of the Patriot Act being unconstitutional. But when we reminded them as to why it was unconstitutional, they got a little lesson. And then I got to talk about one of the issues that is near and dear to me. And I looked at all of them, and I addressed them all, and I said, okay, guys, now, you want to be Republicans? You want to really make a change? Look at this audience. They all know what I'm talking about. So do you know what Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 actually means? And they looked at each other, and they had these weird looks on their face like, no. I said, well, if you did, then you'd realize that we have the answer to the issue at hand, which is Obamacare illegal? Of course it is. It's unconstitutional. Is what we're doing in Libya illegal? Of course it is. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows us to do these things. All of these issues that that Obama's been doing, you know, redistribution of wealth, pick your bill that he has put his pen to, said every one of those bills that he put his pen to can be nullified immediately with the acknowledgement that we have elected an ineligible president. Well, he was born here. Excuse me. Again, you need to understand Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5. And I had one of them actually read it out loud. And they didn't understand it as they were reading it because they didn't understand the context in which it was given. I had to explain to them that our founding fathers put that in there for one reason and one reason alone, and that was to preclude the possibility of us electing a president with divided loyalties. Now, it's interesting that after my little 5 to 10 minute diatribe, I don't even know how long it went, because when you start talking with passion and knowledge, the time just kind of slips by. But I gave them a quick understanding as to what it was, and then got them to agree to read and understand that part of the Constitution, because the last time I saw all of these people at one of the meetings, and I reminded them, I said, what part of the Constitution are you willing to ignore? And they all got up there and they were giggling and they said, of course, none of it. None of it. I reminded them of that tonight. And that's when I hit them with the reality that they know nothing about the Constitution. It's words to them, but it's not words to us. Because without it, our kids and our grandkids have no future. And I will not, by God, I will not allow them to be slaves to anything or anybody And that's why that document was created, to prevent us from being slaves to anybody but ourselves.
Carl, in the next meeting, you should read them the Communist Manifesto.
Oh, no, no. They'll probably be agreeing with that sucker. Now, I have to stick. Listen, I have a purpose. I have a reason for doing what I'm doing. Now, I might wind up being wrong. But apparently, the numbers of people that are hopping on the bandwagon that has left the station here agree with me, and agree with where I'm trying to go, and agree with the fact that, hey, this really is possible. We can, from the inside, influence. We can get these people to actually abide by the oath that they take. We can get them to understand what that oath means. And we can do it on a local level, at a district level. And by God, if I have any success on Sunday night, we'll begin to do it at the state level.
Well, I totally agree with you. I totally agree that we've got to make these changes from the grassroots. We've got to push it there. You've got to get grassroots support, and we've got to make changes at the local and state level, starting with the precincts. But we've got to accomplish some things at the state level in order to protect our sovereign rights as individuals residing in the state. And the only way that we can really stop some of that tyranny from the federal government is to have the state step in and be a barrier for that. And right now they're not. I mean, we've got one sound money legislation situation over in Utah that's happened, and they watered it down so bad it's almost useless. But I want to come back to these grand juries, and I want to come back to the significance of the fact that these charges have now been submitted to sitting federal grand juries, which has not happened before now, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. Because, as you know, most opportunities to get this information before a sitting grand jury are nipped in the bud by, I don't care who it is, clerks at the court level, DAs, whatever. They're just typically not allowed to get in front of them. Walt, being another bull in a china shop, will have no part of that. He knows his rights. He knows his constitution. He took an oath to defend it, and by God, he wants these people to understand it as well. So he's gotten before the grand jury. Now, I don't know what they're going to do with it. Just because you get it there doesn't necessarily, guarantee that they're going to rule the way you want them to rule. But Walt's charges they're manyfold. They have to do with the treasonous actions of the judges in Tennessee. They have to do with the fraud and treason of Barack Obama. They're manyfold. But he's got it in front of him.
Walt seemed to believe that because he had sent this off to the courts or the grand juries back in March, mm-hmm. and it somehow got sent back to him, and I'd kind of like for you to explain how that happened. But also, he puts forth in his interview with Sharon Rondeau at Post Email, which I just posted the link in chat on that particular article. He makes a claim there that because they knew it was coming back, it may have had something to do with the rushed release of this forgery, this forged birth certificate from Obama. And you said you had a different take on all of that today, as I recall. So.
Not in relation to Walt, but unfortunately, you see, Walt has put forward the proposition that Barack is in fact foreign born. Okay, that's one of his charges. And you may be very very right in saying that somebody in the power to be structure knew that this was going to be forthcoming. They may not have known that it was going to be this wild of a document, a doctored document that was going to be put out there, but they knew that something was going to be put out there. So I have, you know, it does hurt. It does hurt his case a little bit, but it helps other cases. It helps in the case of trying to make people understand that. I've got this annoying beep going on in my phone where somebody's trying to get in there. Finally, they gave up. Okay. There's two ways to approach this. For me personally, and then for Walt. Walt's case is hampered by this somewhat. It doesn't really prove anything if you look at the possible tampering of this particular document. It could be another red herring. We don't know. We'll probably never know. But there it is. But that's not the only thing he put in front of them. He also put in front of them, as far as I know, he put in front of them the jury tampering of the Tennessee grand jury system as a whole, and the actions of the 10th District there in at the courthouse in Monroe County, Tennessee, specifically. So I don't think he's putting all of his eggs in that one basket. I really don't. And that, you know, if they did, in fact, know that this was coming down, doesn't that speak to some sort of convoluted conspiracy?
Well,
for me,
who all are the plaintiffs on this? Because I'm seeing in what Sharon wrote about in her interview with Walt that there was that this actually is coming from the military from additional plaintiffs. Is that the case or?
Look, I don't have that in front of me right now. I can't quickly get to a computer. So I don't know who the actual people are that are cited in that one, and I must plead ignorance to that. I really must.
Well, the article doesn't list them either. The article only mentions others, that there are others, and that it's coming from the military, not just from an individual.
Well, yes, there are. And I know the names. I don't know if he wants those names out there. He probably provided those to the grand jury, but I think he wanted to keep those kind of secret at this point in time.
I wasn't looking for a disclosure of who they were. I'm more looking for the significance of that.
Well, to show that it is the military people that are ultimately concerned with what is going on, that it is not just average citizens like me, because I have also filed criminal charges alleging fraud and treason. And I was part of a mass filing to Mueller with the FBI alleging these charges. They were composed and sent off by one Arnie Rosner out in California. So, you know, there when he says others, ooh, yeah, there's a lot of others. To date, there's been something like 3,500 criminal complaints put out there.
Now, to make a false charge, which this is a charge, this is an accusation that has been submitted to this grand jury.
That's
and
correct.
To make a false accusation to the grand jury, does that not subject you to a consequence if it's a false charge?
That absolutely it does. Absolutely it does.
And even though Walt sent this in back in the middle of March, they have not come back to arrest him, but he fully expected that could happen when he sent it, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because here's what happens. In order for them to prove, because they must prove without a shadow of a doubt, that he did issue a false charge. Well, guess what? In order to prove that, they must provide the evidence. The evidence is in the form of, oh, yeah, an original, un, doctored long-form birth certificate, and also all of the records that have since been requested and denied, like the college records, school records, records from the Senate, you know, all of the things that we've been trying to get from the get-go. Those are all included in there. Therefore, in order for them to pursue charges with him, he, in turn, gets discovery of those items. And that, my friend, is why they will never arrest him for that. Because they don't want to release those items.
Well, couldn't the fact that he's issued this forgery, but it does admit that his father was not a U.S. citizen, I'll bring this up to Walt myself, but it seems to me that that would allow him to offer a supplement to what his charges have been sent into to the juries, to include the fact that he has, by his own admission, acknowledged not being a natural born citizen, which kind of removes the red herring of the birth certificate, because I've always said that demanding a document like that is a red herring, because, you know, what's to prevent him from coming forth with a fraud, just like he has. I wasn't expecting it to be such a poor fraud, but I was expecting him to come forth with a fraud.
Yeah. Well, there again, a supplement, absolutely, because we know that either way this went, that was going to bode ill for Mr. Storrow, because on one hand, if he admits to, which he now has on record, he has said, well, yeah, that's my legitimate birth certificate. Hey, fine, guys, fine. I'm glad you finally came forth, because you know what? No matter how bad this is, it is the first what you have to consider prima facie evidence. And that prima facie evidence, as admitted to by Barack Obama, clearly shows divided loyalties, clearly shows that he is not a natural born citizen. To you and me, to most people who have any kind of understanding of what Article 2, Section 1 means. And by the way, if anybody has questions on that, like I know you don't, Terry, and I know you don't, Red, but to those who do, I strongly suggest you take a look at a video that was put together by a friend of mine. I narrated it, and it's on my website. It's front and center on the top, and it is referenced by the constitutional crisis, and it gives you everything and lays out everything that you need to know about this issue. It really does.
I put your website in the chat, but for those people who are not in chat, why don't you give the address for your website?
It is RiseUp, www.riseupforamerica.com. You just spell it all out, riseupforamerica.com. You'll find many, many links there to articles from the post and email, and it's a veritable plethora of information that I've accumulated over the past couple of 3 years. If you just are curious to read some of that stuff, go for it. But it's been something that I've added to pretty much on a daily basis for almost 3 years now. But
today our host, who's in the background, I don't know what she's doing, but she's back there somewhere, Dr. Kate, posted on her website today a question. And the question was, why such a poor, you know, an obvious fraud, an obvious forgery? Why in the world would they do that? I mean, are they that dumb? What is the real reasons behind issuing something that is such an obvious forgery? And I want to open up the phone lines with that question too, and I'm hoping some people will call in with maybe some different ideas, because, you know, it looks to me, I mean, the obvious answer is that they're throwing Obama under a bus. But what could the false flag be?
I think it was deliberate, because remember, look how long it took to get them to post this garbage and claim it as authentic. Look how long it took. 2.5 years. Extrapolate this out. If they can keep the issue alive and keep people now wondering whether or not this is real or not, well, guess what? They can carry it right through to the next election cycle. That's why. Because they want to keep it. They want to keep people focused on the red herring as long as they possibly can, and that way people will take their eye off the ball and not head towards the one thing that we know to be a fact as far as what has been provided. Now, if it is proven that this is another Dan Rather moment and this is another forgery, well, then we may in fact be back to square one, because we don't know. We don't know, or we didn't know, whether or not Barack Obama really was his father, because we had no prima facie evidence to prove one way or the other. That COLB was not. It was considered invalid. It was struck invalid by virtue of the fact that they covered over those numbers. Any alteration to that document, be it real or conjured, made it an invalid document. On the bottom, it clearly states that. So that alone keeps the issue very much alive. But also, here's something that that Walt shared with me. It's called the five-legged dog, and this was something that Lincoln talked about when he was talking about case law and precedents. If you call the tail of a dog a leg, how many legs does the dog actually have?
Five.
No. It has four. Just because you say something is a thing doesn't make it a thing.
You're right.
We have area code 662 live. You have a question or comment?
Well, where in the world would 662 be calling from? I recognize your voice. Do you recognize mine?
No.
Terry Dodd.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Okay.
Red Beckman. It's good to hear your voice. It's been a long time. Jim Borland.
Jim? Hey, Jim.
There you go. This is Tornado Alley calling.
Oh, goodness gracious. Goodness gracious.
You know, in this conversation, the thing that came to my mind was a debate between Alan Keyes and Barack Obama when he was running for the Senate. And Alan Keyes challenged him on his natural-born status. And he says, so what? I'm not running for the presidency.
Have you been able to find that particular video so that we can use that? Because I have searched high and low. I remember references to that, but I've searched for the longest time to try and get that video. Do you have it?
No, I don't have it, but I was aware of hearing about it, and I'm just wondering, well, why did the media not jump all over that?
That's a rhetorical question, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And my other thought is, whether he is or not, our economic policy is so constitutionally unfounded that it's a train wreck that is destined and has to happen decades and decades and decades ago. We got switched off the track towards a cliff, and it's been a gradual downhill slope, but the momentum is now that you couldn't stop it if you wanted to.
I have a theory there. thanks to the input of many, many people who have done research and helped me out, that this particular sequence of events has historically unfolded many, many times in the past. In our case, in American history, we had a gentleman by the name of Adam Weishaupt. Adam Weishaupt was one of those utopians, a communist before there was communism. And his theories, his philosophies, garnered a certain measure of attention from circles like academia throughout the beginning phases of our country. And it kept steamrolling and steamrolling. It was nipping at our heels, nipping at the freedom and liberty that the Constitution endowed us with. Well, actually, our Creator endowed us with, and the Constitution rather codified. But they wanted to nip at the heels of our freedoms and liberties, and that's the way they did it, because the utopians didn't feel like we needed to be ruled by tyrants. We didn't need to be ruled by the system that was created for us. They believed in communism and socialism before it ever really existed. It was here in this country when the first settlers came over. They tried it. The common farm, you know. Everybody works and they put it all into a big pot and they all share it. Guess what? They damn near died. And then they figured out, maybe capitalism is better for us. Maybe the individual should be responsible for the individual and not responsible for the collective. And those were really the roots of what we ended up fighting for in the Revolutionary War. We understood that the individual, with God-given rights, natural rights, was the ultimate arbiter. That did not sit well with the utopians. And they never, ever stopped, because they didn't want to work. They never left us. Here we are today. Here we are today with a share the wealth mentality that permeates the society. A redistribution of wealth. Oh, isn't that just a wonderful thing? Forget that it's been tried everywhere and failed. Let's try it here. It is the classic example of insanity. And yet, here we are. You know, I can tell you about my understanding of the Act of 1871 being one of the death knells, maybe the biggest. I can tell you about the dissolution of the representatives from the 10 southern states after the war, after the Civil War, where representatives were assigned to vote for those 10 southern states. That's one of the things that kind of killed this country. You know, I can tell you about that, and I can tell you that it gained momentum in the early 1910s or 1900s, and with what Woodrow Wilson did in giving us the Fed and that wonderful little incident that occurred on Jekyll Island. You know, we can talk about that till the cows come home. But the bottom line is, talking about it, it doesn't get anything done. We need action, people, because we've been so dumbed down. So dumbed down. And we're so lazy and irresponsible. Exactly where they want to put us. They. Who are they? Well, they are the utopians. They are the socialists. They want us to suck on the tit of government, thereby giving the government power over us. We took that away with the Constitution, so they took the Constitution away from us. Now, what are we going to do about it? And that's my thing right now. What are we going to do about it? There's only two ways. I'm sorry. I've tried everything that I know, and I'm not saying I'm going to give up, not by a long shot. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. But there's only two ways.
Mr. Swenson,
one is
can
with
I make
bullets,
a comment?
And the other is with the ballot box.
Mr. Swenson.
Yes, sir.
Can I make a comment, please?
Please.
You know, Thomas Jefferson said that we should chain and bind the Constitution down, or bind the government down by the chains of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
And that chain has to be made up of what? Individual links. And individuals who are constitutionally literate enough to have the binding effect to bind the government down from mischief. That doesn't exist. There are not enough people who are constitutionally literate to bind this government down. That's why we're in the situation that we're in.
Well,
I wish it were otherwise, but that's where we are.
Yes, sir. You're right.
Edmund Burke made a statement. He said, when evil men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one. One of the biggest hurdles that I have is finding genuine men and women.
Well, Red Beckman has been awfully quiet for a long time. I just want to make sure you're there, Red.
I'm here yet.
Well, Red, have you heard anything thus far that you would like to comment on as far as what I have said?
Well, I'm of the opinion that the biggest problem we have in this country, of course, is that, well, I shouldn't say the biggest. One of the most visible problems that we have in this country is that the people have been dumbed down, and that's what came out just a little bit ago here. Now, what we have to remember is that the people we're dealing with in the government, almost, I would say, 99% of them, because that little inner circle of just a few families is such a small percentage of our national population that they don't... We don't even have to consider them at this point in time. We're dealing with people that work for government, who went to the same schools, the same churches, read the same newspapers, and everything else. The only difference is that when they go to work for government, they end up being in a position where they have an interest in government and how it operates to their benefit. And so we, at this point in time, this is what we're contending with out here in our daily living, is bureaucrats who... they really don't like what they see and what they hear, but they're trying to hang in there until their pension, they can get their pension. And I've seen a number of these that got to the point where they could get their pension, and it's almost amazing because their politics change overnight once they're outside of government. We have to do a better job of educating. In the Patriot movement, I've been involved for over 35 years. We have talked over the top of the heads of 98% of the people out here. We've been talking Federal Reserve. We've been talking the public education and the news media and the churches and all these different things that are, you might say, stacked against us because of the people that operate those things, all going to the same schools that we did. And, you see, this is what happened to me. I came out of the service in 1952, and I was determined to become part of the political process. I wanted to hold up my end with my vote and such. And after 20 years, I experienced this terrible frustration and this feeling that my vote didn't count for anything, that I wasn't accomplishing anything, whatever, and that I had to figure out what it was about our system that wasn't working and why it wasn't working and such. And so I had to start hitting the books. I always liked history, so that wasn't too hard to do. I'll never forget when I first read the story on Magna Carta. In 1215 A.D., King John of England was an outlaw, and he claimed ownership of all the land, that all the people were serfs on his land, and they had to pay him a portion of their productivity and such. And but he was just an outlaw, and his administrators, the barons, a lot of them recognized that, you know, this was not a good situation, and some of them got their heads together. They didn't dare, all of them, because there were some that would have gladly turned them in to the king, and they'd have probably been executed for treason and that type of thing. But they got together and they formed Magna Carta. They wrote this thing out, and they went to King John and they said, "We want you to sign this law." And King John looked at it and he says, "Oh no, I'm not signing that." He said, "That law takes me from the top and puts me on the bottom, and it puts the people, the serfs, on top of the system." And he refused to sign, and the baron said, "Well, we'll go to war. We'll get an army, and we'll have to get you educated, I guess." And so we all read in our history books in school about the Battle of Runnymede and how that the barons won the war, and they caught King John out there and on the battlefield, and they held him right on the point of their swords and said, "You will sign Magna Carta, or we will kill you right here." And so he signed Magna Carta, and it just reversed everything. It put the people on top, and it put the king on the bottom.
What
now,
year was
this
that?
Is the This is what
1265?
Why?
What year was that? Was that 1265?
1215 A.D. And so, 1215. Now, this is the concept that the founders were working on, and they understood this, the principle involved. And, of course, they were well aware of the fact that between 1215 A.D. and 1776, when our War of Independence got started, They were well aware of the fact that there was 43 times at least that the English people had to confront their government and bring them back under the law. There was no less than 23 of those times that the people had to take their arms, and there was blood spilt because the government didn't want to come back under the law. And so the founders understood all of that. And so I find that we've got a lot of people today that are studying the Constitution, and they're not really profiting by all of their study and their energy that they're focusing on it. And the reason for that, of course, is that they don't understand the intent. They don't understand the intent of the Constitution. And they don't understand it, and they don't once they understand the intent, then the Constitution, I mean, everything is, it is so easy to understand. But we've got people out here, thousands of them right now, that are in home study groups and such, studying the Constitution. And they don't make heads or tails out of it because they don't really understand the principle how that they, the people, are the masters. And they haven't, recognized that they are now serfs on the land in this country. And the people that we're having our battles with are people that they're operating under the same burden of misinformation and such as we are, in that they told us in the government school that the only control we have is our vote on election day. And, of course, that's where we're at right now, and that's why we're here at this situation in history. We're there and we're look at what happened with the Tea Parties. They went out and really applied their muscle to getting some people elected to the U.S. Congress, and in our paper here today, it was telling about some of these people that are home on the Easter break, and how that they're just getting chewed up and spit out at the town meetings because they went to the Congress and they were not representing the way the people back home wanted them to, and so none of them understand where they stand in the society. They don't understand that they're on top of the game, and the government is on the bottom. You won't find a bureaucrat that went to school where the same kind of schooling we got, that you won't find a one that understands that the Constitution, when they took that oath of office, they swore to be at the bottom of the pecking order in this country. They made they took an oath to do that, and they don't understand that because they've never gone to the school that really teach the truth. And so this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to put these DVDs out, and of course my feeling is that the DVD is God's gift to the freedom movement in this country. Back in the 80s, we put out a lot of VHS tapes, and they were expensive. They were a pain in the neck to get duplicated and all of that thing, and the quality was sometimes questionable. And they were expensive, as I say, but the DVD... I have a friend in Montana who buys them by the thousand, and they're costing him 27 cents a piece. And he is going to be putting these DVDs out there available for $1 a piece. And that's we're going to reach the people of this country with this information. How do you pick yourself up off the bottom and put yourself up on top of the system? And we've got to reach the public servants out there that have been taught that if they work for the government, they're on top and they're, you know, invincible. They've got all this power. They've got to recognize that they are to be at the bottom of the heap, not the top. And so we've just got to go through what the English people did in England, back there in those years, where 40 some times they had to force their government back under the law. And that's what we've got to do today.
Rick, can I say something?
Go ahead, I'm done.
All right, listen. You're kind of saying, you're kind of talking the bad news. Let me tell you the good news. Let me tell you the good news. Your message, the message, is now resonating. It took a long time, but it is now resonating. And it is resonating at the grassroots level. Now, are we going to get it right all the time? No. Now, we've got to work on it. It took over 100 years for us to get where we're at right now. And it's going to take a little bit of time for the education, the real education, to take root. And people like me are all over the place. They really are. And it's because of people like you that have taken the time to try and get the information to us that the school system would keep from us, that we are going to succeed. And I'm here to tell you, we will succeed. This is no longer just a gathering at the local eatery where you have 5 or 10 people that have done some reading on the Constitution, and they get up and they talk and they, they wax eloquently about this, that, and the other. No. Now, we're talking about people now who have taken the time. Now, are they as literate in history as they need to be to get the full meaning of what you just said? The answer is no. No. I ran across it tonight. I will run across it on a daily basis. But you know something? The good news is that they're hungry. They're hungry for this. They know that this is convoluted. They know that it's wrong. They know that where we're at right now, we shouldn't be here. Our Constitution guaranteed us a different life. It really did. And they get it now. And they're starting to understand. And people like me are a dime a dozen. Because I'm seeing it all over the state, my state, here in Georgia. I will speak your message. I will speak it. They will speak it. And we will make them understand. And we will make them teach this. We will make them be the public servants that they are supposed to be. It's going to happen. It's inevitable.
Well, guys, we have a perfect situation to test whether or not this is really resonating with people. Now, I spent 2 years in Knoxville, Tennessee, and lived in the old Jock Dorm Stadium, you know, the dorms right in Neyland Stadium for a while. So I'm, you know, I have a good amount of experience with Knoxville, and I know it's come a long ways in, you know, the last 40 years, but since I've been there. But Knoxville is we're about to find out what the people of Knoxville are all about, because assuming that those two sitting federal grand juries are not stacked like they were down in the grand jury was in Madisonville, down in Monroe County, assuming they're not stacked, we're going to find out if anybody on those grand juries understand their right to judge the law and their right as a juror. Because if that information that Walt has submitted and you participated in, Carl, if that information is not taken and a presentment come out of those grand juries, then we will know that it hasn't resonated enough yet. But they've got an opportunity right there in Knoxville right now to demonstrate that they understand what their unalienable rights are that are reserved in the Constitution. They will they're going to show us whether or not anybody there at all has a clue of what their power is as a grand jury member. Most people in this country still will figure out a way to avoid that duty when they think their vote at the ballot box is not counting, and then they turn around and waste the one vote that could count more than any other vote that they could possibly have as a grand juror if they choose to investigate and use their subpoena power to investigate this fraud that has been committed on this country by having an ineligible person sitting in our White House. So we've got the perfect meter right now to determine how much it's resonating with those people. And Red, we've got about 15 minutes left. What I'd like to hear from Red is what you would do, Red, if you were given instructions or if you to one of those jury members, or if you were on that jury yourself right now, what would you be telling those other jury members?
I think that, you know, you and I talked a little bit on the phone this afternoon, and I mentioned the U.S. Criminal Code, Title 18, and I mentioned a statute. And I'm going to read that here. I'm going to read that statute. I've got it right here. This is misprision of felony. Here's what the law says. Whoever, having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States, conceals and does not, as soon as possible, make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States, shall be fined not more than $500 or in prison not more than 3 years or both. Now, this is coming right out of our book, The Law That Never Was. And I don't know how many sites we've got. One, two, three. We've got at least three or four sites in there having to do with crimes such as we're being exposed to here with the Obama situation. But what I wanted to bring this 18 U.S.C. 4 out. You don't want to go to a grand jury. You don't want to go and confront a judge or anybody without citing this section of the law. And you have to impress on them the fact that you are obeying the law. You are complying with this Title 18, Section 4 when you bring this crime to their attention. And then we have to impress on them the fact that if they don't do anything about it, then they are guilty of violating that section of the U.S. Code. And so what this does, of course, when you confront them on the record with the fact that you're just complying with the law, you're not just blowing a bunch of smoke, you're telling them what the law is, and you're complying with the law when you confront them with the fraud and the malpractice that we've had so much, you know, in our system at this point. I think that we're just so close to reaching the point where some of these angry Americans are going to be called for grand jury duty. And they have seen our DVDs or our television. We did that one program in 1993 that is on Google, and it's all over the Internet,
on I don't know how many websites. It's been teaching the people all these years about the power of the grand jury and how that we are to be using the grand jury vote, our grand jury vote, to keep government honest. And I think that now, well, 25 years or so ago, I'm sure it was at least that long ago, I would be speaking someplace, and in the question and answer period, people would say, well, how long is it going to take? When are we going to be able to see some results of what we're doing now? And I would tell them, I say, I don't think we'll see much in the way of results until we have an economic meltdown. Once that happens, people, their hearing improves, they're being hurt, they're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, and all this kind of thing. And when that happens, you can get to these people, you can get them to listen. And when you get an angry American, when you get him to listen and get him educated a little bit, he can get real dangerous in a hurry. And if he gets called for grand jury duty, he's not going to be just somebody that's sitting there warming a pew, warming a chair in the grand jury room. He's going to be speaking out. And I'm optimistic at this point. I think that we have some things going for us that look pretty good. And I'm just glad we've got Carl and people like him talking about the grand jury, because I talked about grand juries for 25 years and nobody seemed to hear what I was saying. But that's the beauty, of course, of producing the television specials and writing the books and all that, because the books are out there, the videotapes are out there, and when these people get angry enough to watch and try to figure out what's going on, the information is available. With that, I'll quit right now. Yeah.
And, Red, I want to let you know that your life's work is now being carried on, and it will be carried on in ways that you would never have imagined, because I am very, very blessed to have so many people in my organization, and we're talking hundreds strong on the district level, that are taking this message to the state right now as you speak. So thank you for all of your hard work. Thank you, because it's people like you that inspired me to do what I am now doing. Thank you, sir.
Well, there's a lot of people like you out there, but I've got my future. I've got my future pretty well locked in. But even after I'm gone off the scene here, I'm still going to be kicking butt. Because of the television and the books, they're going to go on and on. And that's a kind of a, what would you say? It's a kind of a stimulant, to try to make sure that I hang around a little longer, because I want to see some more of this exciting stuff happen. I want to see it happen. I know that on the other side, I'll look back and be glad I'm out of it, I suppose. But I've been so much a part of it for so long that it's going to be, I want to be in on some more of it. I see things happening. I want to be part of it.
You will. You will. I'm going to make damn sure you do. So you hang in there, my friend. You keep those breaths going. Make them shallow if they have to be, but keep going, because I want you to see the results, the fruits of your labor.
I read that article, Title 18, Section 4. You always want to use that when you're talking to judges or prosecutors or government service people of any kind. military. We tried to bring the evidence on the 16th Amendment fraud to the military. We didn't get any place, but I got a hunch that today, after all these no-win wars and such where they've murdered a bunch of our best young men and such, I got a hunch that we've got a military today that is not real thrilled and not real happy with our government. And so at some point here, we may reach somebody in the military that'll stand up and say, hey, I've had it brought to my attention that there's a crime been committed, and the law says I've got to do something about it.
Thousands of people, thousands. Thousands of people have been incorporating that title.
Mm-hmm.
Have been incorporating that in their criminal complaints. In the possession of the juries, it's out there.
Yeah.
We're using it now.
Yeah, it's so potent. When you say, well, hey, I'm obeying the law. Are you going to obey it? And you really put them on the spot.
I've put Secret Service agents, FBI agents, all of them on notice by saying those things, by writing those things, by documenting those things, by letting everybody know that it is misprision of felony. It is. And you now are in possession of this knowledge, and it is up to you to do something with it. All of that's been documented. So all of these people will have hell to pay by their ignorance, by their...
They can all be prosecuted.
Every one of them. Names and numbers. We've got them.
I believe that every federal judge in the United States belongs in prison, because they've all been noticed of the crime of the 16th and the 17th Amendments, and they have done nothing but try to cover it up.
As Lincoln would say, it's all about the five-legged dog. It really is. Just because they say it's so doesn't mean it's so.
Yeah.
And with that, I'm going to bid a fond adieu to all of you guys. I've got to get to sleep because I've actually got to get to work tomorrow. But, man, thanks for everything that you've done. Terry, thanks for having this program. Thanks for having me on here. Walt is he's doing God's work. And I'm, to the best of my ability, I'm right there with him. We're using most of what you have put forth, Red, okay? But more importantly, we're using common sense. We're using common law. We're using God's law. We're using those tools that have been provided that have been long since ignored or forgotten. They're coming back around, my friend. You've done a great job. You and everybody that has been picking up the banner for you. We are there. We are getting so close we can taste it. And I hope to God you can see the results.
I sure love to. Thank you for being on.
Carl, I just want to give you an invite. You're welcome to join us back next Thursday night. Sharon Rondeau should be on with us next Thursday, and I'm sure that you would like to perhaps contribute to that as well. So just to let you know, you're always welcome here at Walls in Our Minds, and I really appreciate you you coming and joining us tonight on a little bit of short notice.
I'm sorry I was late getting on, but then again I'm not, because then Red got a chance to talk a little bit more. Dr. Kate, I'm thrilled to be a part of this. Terry, thank you for inviting me. If I can be there for you next Thursday night, I will. Just shoot me an email or something so that you can give me some remembrance or something, because I'm going in so many different directions right now and trying to get the message out there that sometimes, just sometimes, these things
we'll give you a
heads.
We'll give you a
heads up.
I need
people covering my back, too.
We're up against the end of the show, so I want to say thanks to Jim and all of our listeners tonight. Red, always good to be your partner, buddy. We'll be back next Thursday night with Walls in Our Minds.
Good night, everybody.